in your opinion, what was going on in the Al-Shifa hospital? What was the problem there? Why they attacked this hospital?
It was Israeli operation, which was obviously the false flag in many senses, because they were trying to kind of, you know, throw in the weapons and all other implement of Hamas. So maybe there was the issue of some indeed crucial Hamas people being there. But it could be also, judging by what is happening right now, they really looks like they are absolutely obsessed now with wiping out Palestinian population. I mean, there are many, obviously, different type of vectors in the, not just Netanyahu, but in Israel. Although very many people support this operation, so to speak, I don't think so that all Israelis are that genocidal, you know. So, but there is certainly some warring factions inside Israel, and that could be also the part of the issue.
Is that a political move? Is that a military move? What's the strategy?
I think so. It's all of the above, including some serious, as I already stated many times, some serious religious element. And of course, the fact that Netanyahu and his Likudniks, many of them are genocidal maniacs, evidently, they think that this operation somehow may extend his you know, premiership and somehow can, you know, allow him to avoid the jail term. That's a possibility, definitely. So it's all, there is never only one thing practically in anything. There's always a combination of factors. And real analysts, what they do, they actually give their, so to speak, weight to one or the other factor.
How did this conflict in Israel influence the war in Ukraine?
The deal was, I believe, that, and I'm writing the fourth book now, and this is precisely what the deal was. They had these neocons, these fanatical Russophobes, which came with Obama administration on board, like Victoria Nuland, all this Kagan clan, and, you know, those people who thinks that they know how things work. They don't, I can tell you immediately. So, and the deal was, well, let us break up Russia, okay? And then suddenly, after... you know, after 2014, they get their basically butt handed to them, you know, so in practically every respect. And of course, their last illiterate, because they're militarily illiterate, including those generals, US generals who, and UK generals who basically advise them, they're militarily illiterate people. And then suddenly, when you have this catastrophe unfolding, and obviously, as some people from even the Russian intelligence community say openly, that for Biden, actually, this was a gift from heaven in terms of Israel, which shifted focus away from what, apart from the genocidal scale of what they did to Ukraine and what they, you know, throw into the meat grinder. If you didn't know, today, Mr. Naryshkin, the chief of the Foreign Intelligence Service of Russia, went on record, it is all over news, that the intelligence data tells Russia, and this pretty much confirms what have been said for a long time now, that now the United States demands mobilization of people from 17 years old of age up to 70 years of age, and a large share of women. So that tells you everything you need to know. The Ukraine is basically destroyed. And for Biden and whoever this collective Biden is, it's obviously Obama behind him. There is this psycho Hillary Clinton, you know, all kinds of people. So they understand that once it's the done deal, which is being done as we speak, there will be a lot of attention about this. You know, it's the debacle which makes Afghanistan or Vietnam look tame in comparison. And so suddenly, as Mr. Churchill, you know, as I repeated all the time, was saying that, you know, never allow the good crisis go to waste. And guess what? In some sense, this Israeli-Palestinian thing, especially against the background of a serious control of the Israel lobby in the United States of media and things of this nature, it kind of, exactly, shifts focus away from what has been done to Ukraine and what is happening right now to Europe. This is the thing which many people do not understand. Europe is being sacrificed as we speak right now. It is basically going to be drowned into the ethnic and religious strife, and it is being deindustrialized with a terrifying speed. So there's a lot to be answering for. And for them, because they cannot think, they do not know how to do strategy. They don't understand how to think long-term and how to arrange things. So for them, it's just basically knee-jerk reaction. It's like, oh, yes, we have this crisis. Let's kind of shift it. But then, of course, now when Israel begins to basically, you know, provide everyday pictures of the genocidal, you know, ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, then it becomes a problem too. And so suddenly this is catch 22, you know, it was good from the start, but then what Israel is doing and the United States is now trying to pull Israel from the brink of the war with Lebanon. And war with Lebanon means what? Hezbollah. And with Hezbollah means what? Iran and then Syria. So, and Israel doesn't have wherewithal. Israel, we already saw the Israeli Defense Force, it just sheer incompetence. Apart from the fact that Israel economy is rather small and it's small population country, it's around 11 million. Can you imagine now taking out something like 200,000 of their working age population, male population from the labor force? Economically, it's already suffering. It will get much worse.
Lloyd Austin was in Ukraine. He was talking about we are going to continue supporting Ukraine, sending weapons, sending funds to Ukraine. What was the reason behind this visit? Was he trying to convince Zelensky to go after negotiations, or he was going there to just announce that the U.S. is going to support Ukraine?
United States doesn't have resources to support Ukraine. We have to start with this. Yes, any serious strategist, believe me, United States currently doesn't have any serious strategist. It didn't have them in like long time now. It's marrying your resources, to the political objectives of and military objectives of whatever the wars you do. Austin most likely went there trying to convince Zelensky to transfer power to Zaluzhny. If not, that's probably the last warning to Zelensky that he better do something or he's done. The guy, again, you know, so it, the war is done. Again, that's what many people in the West do not understand, although many beginning to kind of wake up to the reality of it. So I think so. And you see, there is this wrong perception. It's the illness, and I am on the record. It's the illness of those people who graduate from those U.S. military academies, go through all those war colleges. Then, of course, you have this so-called diplomatic corps, which is utterly incompetent. I mean, as I already stated, it's the problem of American higher education, which produces basically in terms of diplomacy, military, and all that things, people who are frauds. They are political operatives and they don't know subject. There's a lot to talk about it. So they still believe that Russia will negotiate. But Russia is in no hurry. And you know what? If they have been smart people, which they are not, there are no smart people in Wall Street Journal or in RAND, or they should have looked at basically what kind of budget Russia basically passed a few days ago. They would have been terrified of it because it's just their, how to put it politely, Russia is not going to wrap it into 2024, which she will with Ukraine militarily. But it's the budget which provides the breakthrough developments on the number of the crucial industrial and technological, directions. And when you look at this, Russia will be primarily dictating the conditions of surrender. That's what the euphemism for negotiation or peace talks is. Russia is not going to go there and start, just trying to, satisfy some kind of demands. No, Russia will go there to discuss how much of Ukraine will be allowed to stay alive as some kind of stateland. The rest of it, well, some people say the Odessa, Nikolaev Odessa is the next thing possible. But Russians are not in rush. And obviously, you know, if it could be arranged that basically transfer of territories or making them confederated territories, and eventually they will vote to break away from Ukraine, Russia would rather do it, you know, slowly and in peaceful manner. Although, obviously, Russia has the ability to do it militarily, and it has right now the total the escalation dominance on every single sector of the front, and much further than that. We are talking about the escalation dominance against NATO, unified force of NATO, if NATO decides to commit suicide. And that's what really drives this whole thing. And you have those people in Washington, let alone London. London is all together. Look at Boris Johnson or Liz Truss. I mean, I don't know. They just elect degenerate after degenerate, you know. And so when you look at these people, they really don't know what to do. The only thing they know, they got this euphemism. It's a new thing that in their narrative they call counteroffensive stalled. So it's a code word that basically it's over. And of course, obviously, they try to kind of push this agenda, but it's useless. I mean, for crying out loud, they are in no position right now to ask for something or dictate anything. Washington will be dictated to what it's going to do. And we already have some signs of the contacts and change of tone between United States and Russia.
We know that there is a battle in Avdiivka that is going on, and it seems like a new Bakhmut for Ukrainians. How do you find it? What's the importance of Avdiivka for Russians, for Ukrainians, in your opinion?
For Russians, it is important only from the point of view, if you look at kind of the short term, that it is primarily this fortress, essentially. The whole area is fortress. It was built into fortress for the last 8 years, including by the supervision of and advisors from England, United Kingdom, from United States. And it is the main fortified area for the armed forces of Ukraine. It is the anchor on which both flanks of the extremely large front are held. It is also the precise position where to conduct the terror shelling of Donetsk area. So this is, for them, losing this is a catastrophe, basically, you know, that the front, well, it's already crumbling. I cannot even emphasize enough, because now every day, it's literally every 5-6 hours, you have this news, you know, the Russian units breaking through. And you have to understand that Avdiivka area itself, apart from their settlement itself, their what is called the town of Avdiivka, the main thing is there, of course, the coke plant. And Russians already in the industrial zone, they already liberated industrial zone. And once the gap, basically, which is the called operational envelopment or operational encirclement, fully controlled, fire controlled by Russians. So we're looking what? Nobody knows exactly how many of them are there, but it varies from 30 to anywhere between 30 to 50 to 70,000 Ukrainian troops staffed in this area. So you can imagine what it's going to be. And again, Bakhmut wasn't that important. The whole story of Bakhmut is there for people who understand who Prigozhin and Wagner were. You know, Bakhmut wasn't even the priority. It was the whole accidental thing, let's put it this way. But Avdiivka is. And yeah, Russians already kind of reducing the pocket itself. And whatever will, just to give you an example, yesterday, in one of the flanks, okay, the whole company, 100 people, you know, of armed forces of Ukraine surrender. Fully, 100%, you know, 100 people, the whole company. Now you have the surrendering is happening like in squads, you know, between 8, 7, 8, 10 people by platoons. So you're beginning to look at these things, which are getting the whole tactical units begin to surrender, let alone that what's, you know, all kinds of other people. So it's just a matter of time, and Russians, again, not going to rush. Why? Why do you want to kill your men unnecessarily when you can do it absolutely what less speed, but much more safe, many more saved lives? So, and essentially, yeah, the Avdiivka also has this extremely extensive tunnel system, but this tunnel system was not something like what Hamas dug in Gaza. This was a tunnel system related to the operation of this huge coke industrial zone. So many of them will sit there. So it could be a repetition of Mariupol for all intents and purposes. But Russians are already inside Avdiivka.
You talk about Zelensky and Zaluzhny. In the eyes of the U.S., what's the difference between these two figures? Are they different from the point of view of the U.S.? So why are they trying to replace Zelensky if there is no difference between them?
Well, because Zelensky is already basically is a loose cannon, and he's completely discredited material. He's a waste, basically. He's political waste, and he is now, it's not their asset, but actually the detractor from the United States already extremely weak geopolitical position. So Zaluzhny will be just more cooperative puppet, you know, and at least he might steal less than Zelensky did. So that's the only difference. Zaluzhny is not good general. Basically, there are no good generals in those NATO-educated, quote-unquote, Ukrainian generals. They are utterly incompetent, and that is why, for example, armed forces of Ukraine, especially on the tactical operational level, they have been discarding all those NATO manuals because they just don't work. They kill people. And that's the result. That basically tells you everything you need to know about NATO training and NATO understanding of the modern war. And Zaluzhny is, how to put it politely, the guy lost everything he fought for. But he is a useful tool, you know, so, and at least it's the last attempt, so to speak, desperate attempt of the United States to have at least somebody presentable who both can be talked to by Russians. They think that Russians will be interested to talk to him, although Russians already stated, we don't talk to those people. We're going to be talking to Washington. But they still think that. That's how delusional they are. Take anybody from State Department, from Pentagon, from the top political levels, National Security Agency, all those people, they are completely delusional. But Russians, including from Mr. Putin, Mr. Lavrov, Mr. Medvedev, and Mr. Patrushev, and I can sit and just talk about the biggest names in Russian politics today, but they already stated, what's the point talking to Ukrainians? The only negotiations could be between Moscow and Washington. So that's the level where it will be all settled. The rest of it, I mean, if need be, Russians will basically, you know, reduce the Kyiv regime to, well, Kyiv regime is doomed anyway, you know. So, and it just, as I already stated from the beginning of our conversation today, it is about how much of Ukraine will be left, period. That's the main thing.
Who's the face of these neo-Nazis in the Zelensky administration? And if you compare Zaluzhny and Zelensky, who's the most in favor of neo-Nazis?
I don't think so. Zelensky is Nazi per se. He is opportunist, and he is very high on drugs. He is absolutely drugged, and his psychological and physiological state is absolutely, he is done. He is done. So he is not the figure you can even touch, you know, with the 3-yard stick, because that's how he thinks now. Zaluzhny, I mean, I think so. He also is opportunist, and he probably a Ukrainian nationalist. But there is a funny thing. Now, even Azov Nazis, Azov, which is not really battalion, it's actually brigade size military force. And of course, there's a political force of which are real true Nazis. Again, the true Nazis are in Washington and in London. They were the guys who wanted to use them. They used them. And now they're smeared with this for the rest of their lives, because the amount, the scale of the crimes against humanity and war crimes committed by there, as remember the FDR said about, what's his name, Somoza. he's son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Well, at least Somoza wasn't Nazi, open Nazi. These guys from Washington and London, they smeared themselves, and they are the biggest Nazis because they used it. They agreed tacitly or openly with the fact that we're dealing with the outright Nazis and genocidal maniacs. And that's their, you know, basically a stamp now. In this particular case, even Azov says that we need to peace talks with Russia. Russians obviously not gonna communicate with Azov. Russians gonna annihilate whatever is left of it, up to including physical, you know, elimination of their top of it. So, and there you go. So the biggest Nazis are in London and in Washington.
Janet Yellen today said that U.S. cannot afford Ukraine losing this war. My question is that, can U.S. afford losing all of Ukrainians?
Janet Yellen, obviously, with her many years in the military academies and service and, you know, attending, she is a complete bimbo. She is, I mean, she is absolutely clueless. But that's, again, that's the whole thing. You know, we talk about this tactical operational minutia. You have to understand, many people I wrote about for 9 years. Now many people didn't believe that. Can they be that ignorant and incompetent? I said, guys, we didn't even see the whole bottom yet. You know, that's how stupid they are, and that's how they delusional they are. Economically, militarily, politically, they really live in this alternative universe, because obviously it is an alternative universe economically, militarily, and political. You know, and especially when you have the military history of your country confabulated primarily, not taking anything from the heroism and dedication of the, for example, American servicemen, GIs and sailors, you know, who fought bravely, let's say in World War II or in Pacific theater, you know. But after that, I'm sorry, guys. I mean, really, show me the money, as the, you know, in the movie. Show me the winning record. Show me any strategist of, you know, scale. Show me something which you want. And you look at this as like, well, yeah. And now you have the girl who, I mean, she is a banker. And that's the problem. That's the problem with the United States. You have the lawyers and a political so-called fake scientists who have no clue about modern warfare expressing their opinions. They have no clue. They have no background. They don't understand how it all works. They cannot tie together two things. And so Janet Yellen, yeah, sure. It's like me, you know, just advising somebody on the during open heart surgery. You know, the result will be pretty bad, let me tell you.
If you look at these 18, 19 months that Russia is fighting, what was the gain for Russia strategically? So what Russia has learned in these 18, 19 months of this war in Ukraine?
Well, I will not disclose anymore any secret of that, because my friend, Colonel Vladimir Trukhan, already spoke openly. We were discussing this while I was in Moscow, that basically Mr. Gerasimov and Russian general staff, they're not just fighting the war. This is not the point. It's clear that Russia is already won. They are shaping the military force for the 21st century. And right now, it's not even arguably, this is the best fighting force in the world. And in terms of what, well, even Colonel McGregor says, this war is paradigm shift. And that is why we're talking about those people in Pentagon, they have no clue what they're dealing with. They never did to start with. They don't understand the culture from, you know, from where it all goes. They don't understand the level of military or any other education in Russia. And so when you look at this, first, of course, Russia has this, what is the crucial thing? It's data set. These are data sets or correlates of war, which allow Russia, and if you look at entirely, especially in the last year, to advance technologically in terms of weapon systems dramatically. It already has, Russia already has had technological advantage over NATO, United States included, when starting their special military operation. Now the gap will only grow, and when you look attentively how not only Russians adjust their new systems, weapon systems, and command and control networks and things of this nature, you can see now the new weapons coming up, which are absolutely mind-boggling. And that's what I was trying to warn when I wrote, my first book. And I was telling them, guys, you don't understand what is happening. And right now, strategically, it's obviously, and I'm on record, you can quote me on this, Russia won the arms race. And in the long run, because we don't have any solid yet forecast on the for the existence of the United States, how it will, proceed as a country. Europe, you can write Europe off by now. This is important part. And the light budget, last budget, which Russia passed a few days ago, it's just mind-boggling. There is just colossal money in all kinds of the R&D, military and military industrial complex, and scientific development and technology development and education development, and this is unprecedented. And of course, the second one, Russia's authority right now in the world among what is called the global South, and incredibly high. And you look at this not only from military point of view, but from the geopolitical point of view, because people like, of course, Chinese watch. Everybody else watches this. And not everybody, well, by far not everybody buys this propaganda, about stalled counteroffensive. And people see, they make their conclusions. And we know now that Africa is future development, for this continent, it's strategic, kind of vector of the global economy. And not only that, all kinds of the countries like Indonesia, and you go, look at them and what they do right now and how they watch this in awe, because it was only Russia alone standing up to the combined West. And they just absolutely, in the state of awe. They are awestruck, and that translates itself and transfers itself into the economic contracts, into the security contracts. That is why BRICS started to grow like crazy. And so make your own conclusions. It is all because of the special military operation.
How do you see these changes that internally has happened in the Russian military?
First, Wagner doesn't exist anymore. It's completely non-existent. It's completely broken up. Most of those people who wanted to continue to serve, they took the oath, and they are now servicemen of the Russian Defense Ministry. You can't forget about Wagner. Plus, not to mention the fact that this whole Wagner story was blown out of proportion, primarily by the Western and, shyster so-called Russian military analysts, quote unquote. It was primarily seen by many, in especially Ministry of Defense, that as the rogue organization, as Scott Ritter, I believe he was the first one who stated this, but essentially it was organized criminal group, just well-armed. And we know now the result. It's not, doesn't exist. It will never exist again. And people who fought, for as professionals, and those who wanted to continue their contracts, they are now Russian Defense Ministry servicemen. So, but in terms of the development of the operational art, tactical methods, writing new field manuals, writing new operational, manuals and directives in terms of how to command and control army of the 21st century, especially when you look at the complexity of all that. It is incredible. It's incredible. You have general staff right now working 24/7, not only on planning things. This is what they do. General staffs plan things, all of them, from how many, honey buckets you need for, somewhere in the rear, and how many meals a day, and what is their material supply of, let's say, uniforms or whatever, to general development of the strategy of the national security and, of course, defense strategies. There's so much right now to sift through and analyze that this already is allowing and will allow even more to design the army, which will be the best army in the world, at least until the mid 21st century, even further, you know, and that also gives a tremendous development of the Russian military industrial complex, a development of the new weapon systems, which we, if that hasn't been impressive enough, there are talking already about the completely new physical principles, weapon systems, and who knows what. Yeah, I can only speculate here. But enough to look at, for example, how hypersonic weapons performed outstandingly in this special military operation. Kinjal is a basically flying horror. You cannot stop it. So, and this is just one of very many, so to speak, facets of this whole situation.
Do they have any private company acting and producing weapons, or all under control of the state in Russia?
Most are under control of the state. Russia will never again allow private, especially interest, especially interest control, as it was in the 90s and early 2000s, controlled by the American or Western European interests inside Russian military industrial complex. So primarily, it's government controlled. For example, you look at those colossal conglomerates. If you look at Rostec, it's just gigantic company. It's one of the largest companies in the world. And when you look at this, this is like, you know, those Japanese Daibatsus, you know, Russians are building now enclosed technological cycle for those gigantic corporations. And yeah, and nationalization of the strategic assets continues as we speak.
You talk about weapons, new weapons that are getting produced in Russia. How about the forces, the army? Is it going to grow in size?
Yes, yes. The ground forces will grow to 1.5 million. The whole armed forces will grow to, I don't remember now the full, I don't have the data from the top of my head, but I believe the Russian ground forces are already growing dramatically, significantly, to the up to, I think so, up to 1 million. Do not forget, Russia is reconstituting the Western Military District, which is, of course, along the border of Finland. And there are also Arctic forces which are growing. There are some Russian forces now in Belarus. And eventually, Belarusian forces will be somehow updated to serve as the type of the subset, so to speak, of the you know, forces of the what is called the Union State between Belarus and Russia. And there are other things which are happening in terms of the reconstituting some of the formations. But one of the major one, of course, is the Western Military District. So there will be initially the core of the ground forces. There are a bunch of the air defense and air forces will be there because Finland is the member of NATO. Well, too bad for Finland, I guess.
Everybody was talking about Wagner Group in the aftermath of that mutiny. They were in the news. They were talking about that this Wagner Group is training the army in Belarus. How is that going on? Is the Russian army that is in charge of that training?
Well, they cooperate. And again, as I already stated, Wagner doesn't exist anymore. Neither do their whatever their serious presence of the remnants of it in Belarus, because Belarus armed forces and Russian armed forces cooperate very closely, very closely. In the end, formally, well, it's not just formally. I mean, Belarus and Russia are the union state. So Belarus is basically part of the defense planning in Russia too. And now with this situation with the West and West going completely insane, Russia, including with significant border of Belarus with Poland, Russia has its own formations there which cooperate very closely on the day-to-day basis with Belarus armed forces to make sure that nothing stupid happens on the Western border with Poland, you know, so... And again, Poland also goes completely bananas now. And but yeah, we, you know what? I mean, the whole West, what is happening right now, I sometimes cannot believe that I'm observing it in the real time. It's just downright both terrifying and fascinating how the whole civilization is killing itself. And so Russians need to keep this basically the barrel of the gun near the temple of the Western civilization to make sure that it doesn't do some stupid thing, which will result in the World War III, and then everybody will be annihilated. So there you go. That's the responsibility now.
How do you see Europe right now, especially Poland and the UK, which were so fierce in their support to Ukraine?
First, Poland is a non-entity militarily, for all its, you know, tanks and everything, as they say, in terms of the real war. They speak like crazy people, they're elites, you know. But generally speaking, Poles are, how to put it, you know, they're people who still kind of psychologically and culturally very close to Russians and Belarusians. I mean, there's a lot of commonality, but it's obviously Polish elite, which are completely insane. And they are obviously controlled traditionally from London. And now, and Poland plays now this spoiler, because now it's completely on their American credit, because United States needed this spoiler in the European Union to kind of break off relationship between Russia and European Union, which they achieved, by the way, great success. They think that it is great success, but reality is, and militarily, United Kingdom is a pipsqueak, you know, as is also economically. They want, they can't provide some Storm Shadow missiles, although France provides now them, and some kind of other material, but it's nothing. It's meager. And you know what? You look at the United Kingdom, the guys, they still cannot face the reality that they are not that important. You know, as I already stated, they are kind of, you know, lapdog. United States, if need be, they will dispose of them too. You know, so United States needs to eat, okay? Russians understand this. And as I already stated many times, I will repeat it again. There are only three superpowers right now in the world. This is China, Russia, and the United States. Between Russia and the United States, they will talk primarily between themselves. You know, if they will begin to talk, granted that some more saner people will prevail somehow in Washington. In terms of Beltway, I don't believe, because the current, most of the current crop of the politicians and military, they are just absolutely useless. They are absolutely brainwashed themselves. They brainwashed themselves, basically. But United Kingdom is not even an entity to discuss with what, you know. It just, these guys, they gave up their pretty much most of their industries. I read about the situation with their, for example, elderly in United Kingdom. It's heartbreaking. You see, that's the point. I may not respect, you know, Downing Street 10 or their parliament, because I don't, you know. But when you look at simple people, and when you look how they have to choose between eating and heating their house, and you know there are tens of thousands who are dying, you know, and will die again because of the lack of energy and heating and what is happening there economically, your heart breaks, of course. And how can I say it? I mean, they are not really big players. They could be controlled like Europe, which United States moved to commit suicide. Obviously, you cannot, you can never discount this possibility. But in the larger scheme of things, they're really not that important.
She was in the U.S. He was trying to rebuild in their relationship with the U.S. And right after that, Biden called him dictator again.
He is definitely a senile old man, you know, and he still lives in his whatever confused world. And even when you look at such neocons as Blinken, you can see the guy literally almost, you know, fainting after he did this. What can I say? I mean, this is everything. This is the epitome of the American ruling class. That's what they are. They are uncultured, they're stupid, they don't know what they're talking about. And again, nobody really cares anymore. And again, that's why I mentioned Garland Nixon. He's beautiful. I mean, to the point explanation. When Z entered this main dining hall, you know, he got standing ovation from the captains of industry in the United States, you know. So, and these are the people who own gigantic sums of money, so, and capital. So that's what really matters. As in terms of, the Biden administration finally did what nobody expected would happen. But they completely humiliated United States and remove the remnants of the reputation of the White House and American government that became the people around the world, they joke about United States. For me, as the United States citizen, you know, and I live here and I definitely have my vested interest in this country, it's humiliating that everybody laughs in the United States. This is how pathetic and ridiculous it all became. And of course, you look at this and just, oh my God, I never saw I would see this, but guess what? We're living through it.
What kind of message would this type of behavior send to Putin and his administration?
I can tell you one thing. Russians right now know about United States more than anybody within the Beltway knows. Russians know about United States more than administration of the White House and all those people and those intelligence so-called community. Russians know. They are just observe it in the real time, how this train wreck, you know, how the country have been destroyed essentially. So they understand they need to talk to someone. Who are you going to talk to? You cannot talk to anybody from the top political echelon of Biden administration. They are Russophobic, you know, genocidal maniacs like neocons, like Victoria Nuland. You're not going to talk to her. You're not going to talk to Anthony Blinken, who is a, you know, just messenger boy, basically. So you're not going to talk with somebody behind the scene, which is, of course, Obama administration and, you know, people of this nature. There's nobody to talk to. You can talk with some people from CIA. You can talk with some people from Pentagon. You know, you can talk to some other people who are at least now at the fringes of the political life, but who still are powerful enough and have enough profile to, in the end, influence something down the road. And of course, first, you have to understand, nobody believes anything what comes from the United States, from the White House, from State Department in Russia. Nobody believes it. You know, United States is non-agreement capable. It doesn't matter what you write, what paper you put it on, whatever seals are, you know, stamped it with, no matter how many promises they give, they will break them. They are basically the only thing they teach in the, for example, American higher education in terms of diplomacy, you know, geopolitics, is how to lie. You know, that's the only thing, because it's the sickness which basically killed already United States, and it's called exceptionalism. So Russians not going to talk to those people. The only people, as I already stated, you can talk are those people in the middle level who, you know, want to make something work because they understand the severity of the situation. So Russians are probably already talking to them. We know this. It has been admitted by Mr. Patrushev. It has been also admitted by no less when a couple of days ago that the Russian delegation headed by Mr. Overchuk was warmly greeted by Mr. Biden and Jill Biden. I mean, politely, wow, this hasn't happened like in a while. So there is some shift, so to speak, in thinking there. But the problem is credit history is credit rating of United States right now is basically so negative that nobody will take seriously anything from.
We know that there are two different concepts. The elites are concentrated on Ukraine and Israel right now. They're thinking of Taiwan. But we have John Mearsheimer, who is a offensive realist. He says that it is not in the interest of the U.S. staying in Ukraine, focus on Israel, because the main problem of the U.S. comes from China. It's a pure competitor of the U.S. Let's focus on China. Are they going to learn anything from this conflict in Ukraine and now in Israel just to go after negotiation, to go after some sort of getting along with China? Or they're going to be more aggressive toward China? How do you see this?
Well, I respect John Mearsheimer for his work on the Israeli lobby. You can only applaud their basically courage and, you know, integrity on this respect. But with all my due respect to John Mearsheimer, he is not offensive realist. He is still American exceptionalist. For example, he has absolutely zero knowledge of Russia, zero clue about the European military history. So him thinking that China is a peer, it's, to put it politely, he doesn't understand what the United States is. You know, and the question, and I'm talking about the United States militarily and politically and economically. Economically, United States is a train wreck, you know. And but then again, you cannot explain to people that, for example, GDP numbers are worthless. And that is why, for example, when he thinks that out of three superpowers right now, the most weakened, the most unstable, and militarily absolutely impotent is the United States. So when John Mearsheimer says that China is a peer, no, United States not even in the same league economically with China and with other social institutions. And neither it is now with Russia, which is growing. Militarily, United States is not competitor to Russia because of the gigantic gap of the technological gap with the weapon systems and things of this nature. So. And that is why when he talks about it, oh, yeah, let's shift to China. To shift with what? That's the whole point. Shift with what? He wants to what? Move three carrier battle groups in, near the first island chain? How does he want to compete with China? I mean, you look at this. It's so ridiculous that people still do not take into account the state their country is in. They don't even see it. And that is why I already stated many times. I mean, I am on the record. Political science is not a science. It's complete fake degrees. And when you have those people who run by this data, which is completely corrupted, it's called GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. So, and this is what they teach them in the American universities. I'm not talking about STEM education. American STEM education so far is okay, you know, it's competitive in some sense. But these guys, they don't understand that practically all humanities field in especially political science, whatever they call it, this fake, pseudoscience, it's garbage, it's trash, they know nothing. And that's the whole point. And that is why Mearsheimer continues to go with this, you know, just beaten to death cliche. And I'm talking about, he has to answer himself a question. What resources does the United States have to go after China? This is ridiculous, you know, and especially so when you look right now at the de facto military alliance between Russia and China, and even the interference of Russia in terms of the material support of China, including but not limited to, for example, transfer of the hypersonic weapons and provision of the targeting with Russian very impressive, you know, satellite constellation. What are you going to do? How are you going to compete with China? You know, and what? You're going to take those snowflakes from the streets, tattooed all, you know, who wouldn't be able to survive in the real world? I mean, how? We have literally the whole generation here in the United States. What is Generation Z, whatever, Zoomers, whatever. Look at them. It's terrifying. They're snowflakes. Not all of them, but most are. And look at the industrial sector of the United States. Yeah, United States still can produce some things like aircraft, for example. But other than that, I mean, what? Computers? Well, you know, it's a long story about this cheap manufacturing, but this is just small part. It's like explaining, John Mearsheimer doesn't know this fact. Again, Russia produces as much steel as the United States. You know, a simple thing, produces five times more of aluminum. Some people, they just cannot count, you know, mathematically, they cannot understand what we are talking about. And as the result, they have these delusions about, you know, delusions of grandeur, while in reality, the United States is basically being packed into its own hemisphere, and it has no resources to fight China. except for obviously sabotaging shipping lanes of communications through the Indian Ocean, you know, so to China. But again, China is moving with the help of Russia all major communications, major supply lines for their fuels, oil, you know, gas and everything inside the continent, you know. And even today, just today's news, nobody probably will notice that Russia and China use 95% in accounts settlement in own respective currencies, ruble and yuan. 5% are for dollar and euro. I mean, hello, it's just ridiculous, you know. So there you go.
Are they thinking of separating Russia from China? Is that possible?
Well, first, we need to keep in mind that China is still very much engaged economically with the United States and combined West. Here's the BRI, you know, Belt and Road Initiative to supply things to Europe, which will have its capability to pay diminish with each day. It is being diminished as we speak, because the situation, financial situation in Europe is horrifying. But it is what it is. And China also operates in terms of, exports for other markets in Asia Pacific. But for now, China and United States are tied pretty closely with the umbilical cord. And Russians are extremely well aware of this situation. United States cannot change its rhetoric and those insane plans, as you say, you know. So China will be playing with Russia for now. So, and especially considering the fact that you cannot exist, without energy. You just can't. If you are a modern civilization, it's not the money which you need. Of course, you need money per se, but you need energy. Where do you get this energy in the, you know, quantities which allow to maintain betterment of China, their basically standard of living? Nowhere near, except for what? Their northern buddy, you know, Russia, which has the gigantic resources. And guess what? This is what happens. What can the United States give China except for opening its markets? Pretty much nothing, really. There's the whole story about their commercial airspace. But I think so United States still has their edge there. But other than that, what? You know, so.
The United States sent a lot of weapons to the Middle East to support Israel, nuclear-capable weapons. Do you think at the end of the day, these countries like Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, UAE, none of them has nuclear weapons? Are they going after nuclear weapons, or are they going to seek some sort of security from Russia and China?
I think so. It's going to be security with BRICS. And we already know Saudi Arabia is Iran is now one of the best and closest allies of Russia. And inevitably, it also extends to a degree for now. It's not formalized. Iran has some very unique views on its own security and things of this nature. But I think so. It's going to be done through the BRICS institutions, especially when you look at Saudi Arabia and when you look at suddenly how Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Iran talking. This is unprecedented, you know? This is what happens. It just so Turkey, theoretically, especially when they get this Akuyu nuclear power plant finished by Russia there, and there are other plans for nuclear power in this area, in general area. Who knows? I think Turkey, if it wants to, probably would be able to finance and do their thing. But primarily, it's going to be about what is their nightmare of neocons and American military-industrial complex, that they will continue to buy Russian weapons, you know? And so, and again, everybody saw the performance of those weapons, especially in terms of air defense. And that could be the case. I don't think so. There will be any kind of formal, military alliance or something like that. But there will be some kind of security structure in place, you know, so to speak, some maybe unannounced behind the scene, you know, negotiations and talks. So it all depends, you know. But you remember what happened to Syria. Syria wasn't very, very predispositioned towards Russia, although it was still remained kind of friendly before the ISIS and, you know, this in the situation which was instigated by the United States and United Kingdom and created ISIS and this horror which was happening there. And suddenly we have, late General Soleimani. He flies to Moscow. He talks about Russians meet with Syrian people and bang. You know, 2015, Russian armed forces and air force is already in Syria. You see? Nothing special, no special super-pooper military alliance, you know? But now you have, basically, you see what is happening. So it's all complicated, but I think so. Primarily, it's going to be done through some BRICS institutions and, you know, some, you know, bilateral type of negotiations.
If we take Turkey out of NATO, what would NATO mean?
Oh, it's already meaningless. I mean, it was created as the allegedly defensive alliance. Well, it never was defensive. It turned out to be basically perpetuating all kinds of wars and conflicts all around the world. But Turkey, it doesn't matter if Turkey is still formally in NATO or not. Fact is, Erdogan, he's a very shrewd politician. He is not friend with anybody but with himself, and he basically is doing the Turkey and promoting Turkey's interests, which is understandable, and that's the only way it's supposed to be. But he definitely has some rapport with Mr. Putin, and especially if we take into the account that it was evidently Russians who played a major role in saving his life during the coup, you know, mutiny in Turkey. So, but Turkish future lies in Eurasia, absolutely. And there is a second thing. Turkey wants to, and vies for leadership of the Islamic world, of Ummah, you know. So Erdogan is forced right now, being especially basically his Muslim Brotherhood guy, you know. So he has to be very radical in his rhetoric. It doesn't mean necessarily the Turks will attack Israel or something like that. But plus, everybody in Turkey, I'm pretty sure, knows about Samson option. And considering not jobs who are in Likud party in Israel, you know, who knows what may happen. But Turkey inevitably will have to drift to the east. And Erdogan understands that, I think.
The news came out, the African corps will appear as part of the Russian armed forces. What does it mean? What's going on?
I don't know what, obviously, that sounds a lot of Rommel type thing, you know, in World War II. I don't know. I will have to read it. I didn't. But I would assume that considering the fact that Russia has vast interests in both Maghreb, you know, in Northern Africa. And again, I, as even naval cadet, I spent some time in Libya, for example. And especially General Haftar is definitely visiting Moscow once in a while. He has ears of many influential people around Kremlin or in Kremlin. Then you have the very friendly Algiers. You know, it's very friendly, and it's also a huge market, not only for Russian weapons, but for other things. So when you look at this, at the Arab Middle East and, you know, Arab Africa, Russia has a very serious interest there. Just to give you an example, the Russians are building now a nuclear power station in Egypt. In terms of size, it's the largest nuclear power station in the world. The scale of it is just gigantic, you know. So, and many Arabs, they understood you cannot rely on the United States anymore because they will sell you to Israel anyway. So it's, and that, you know, so many things are attached. Each development kind of has the ramifications, which are so massive, you know, that it takes sometimes days to just process the information which comes in. So yeah, Russians probably will create some kind of the military force. And there was a talk already that actually there will be a naval base, also Russian naval base in Libya. And considering the expansion of Russian fleet and its It is ongoing as we speak. Yeah, Russian Navy also may need their, obviously their some kind of naval station there. So, and yeah, it's change of the guard globally. So what can I say?